There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel, and I'm your host. On today's program, the FCC takes another shot at hearing about network neutrality. The FCC just got through a meeting at Stanford University in California, and I've got some highlights. And of course, we'll catch you up with a little bit of what's going on in our media environment. Do stay tuned. Well, first, I have to start off with some bad news, unfortunately. Two young community radio reporters were shot and killed on April 7th in Puebla de Guerrero in the southern state of Oaxaca, Mexico. Teresa Bautista Flores and Felicitas Martinez, 24 and 20, respectively, were two journalists working for La Voz que Rompe el Silencio, or The Voice That Breaks the Silence, a community radio station serving the Trique indigenous community. According to Cactus, an organization that supports indigenous communities, the two women were returning from doing a report in the municipality of Llano Juarez in the early afternoon when they were ambushed and, after being threatened with abduction, were finally shot with the kind of bullets used in AK-47 assault rifles. Investigators found 20 bullet casings at the scene. Three other people were wounded in the shooting, a three-year-old boy and his parents. A community spokesman told Cactus, quote, "We are convinced the Oaxaca government was behind all this with the intention of dismantling municipal autonomy," end quote. Although there is not yet any firm evidence of state government involvement, Cactus has called on the federal authorities to intervene. The Director General of UNESCO, Koichiro Matsura, said, quote, "Killing journalists is a heinous crime which harms the whole of society as it undermines the basic democratic right of journalists to hold informed debate and make informed political choices," end quote. The Mexican branch of the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, also known as AMARC, said there have been acts of violence against other small radio stations belonging to indigenous groups in Oaxaca, such as Radio Nandia in 2006 and Radio Calenda in 2007. AMARC has officially condemned the murder of Flores and Martinez and has demanded, quote, "an end to the climate of impunity that is allowing such acts of aggression, disappearances, and murders to continue to be committed against members of community media, as well as journalists and media outlets in general, which is making Mexico the continent's most dangerous country in which to work as a journalist," end quote. Actor Tim Robbins got an opportunity on April 14th that perhaps a lot of Media Geek listeners would like to have. At the National Association of Broadcasters annual convention in Las Vegas, Robbins delivered a keynote speech excoriating the nation's mainstream media industry for its shallowness, its appeal to the lowest common denominator, and for giving a pass to government crimes. When he first took the stage, Robbins had not planned to give the keynote speech he had prepared because he'd been advised it was too long and preachy for the audience. Instead, the plan was for Robbins to engage in an interview with television critic David Bianculli, who appears on NPR and writes for Broadcasting and Cable magazine. Bianculli did appear on stage with Robbins, prepared to participate in the Q&A, and Robbins opened the conversation by mentioning the speech he decided not to give. Bianculli replied that he had actually read the speech backstage and compared it to the famous 1961 speech to the NAB by former FCC chairman Newton Minow, in which Minow famously called television a vast wasteland. Bianculli then mentioned how Robbins had gotten a lot of flack for speaking out against the Iraq War at the Oscars a few years ago. At that point, many in the audience began to applaud. In a post to his blog, Bianculli says then he heard someone in the crowd yell, "Speech!" Robbins asked the crowd if he should give it, and then he received more applause. Here's a portion of that speech.
In all seriousness, folks, let's face it. We are at an abyss as an industry and as a country. And I know that saying we are at an abyss isn't the stuff of keynote addresses. But all sarcasm and irony and rude pithiness aside, we are at a critical juncture in this nation's history. This is a nation divided and reeling from betrayal and economic hardship. And you, the broadcasters of this great nation, have a tremendous power and a tremendous potential to affect change. You have the power to turn this country away from cynicism. You have the power to turn this nation away from the hatred and the divisive dialogue that has rendered such a corrosive effect on our body politic. You can lift us up into a more enlightened age. Or you can hide behind that old adage, "I'm just a businessman. I provide what the audience wants." Well, I'm here to tell you that we don't need to look at the car crash. We don't need to live off of the pain and humiliation of the unfortunate. We don't need to celebrate our pornographic obsession with celebrity culture. We are better than that. Some of you are trying. Some of you are inspiring people. Towards altruism and compassion with your programming. Some of you are trying to lift the civic dialogue into a more responsible and adult arena. But I know you do so against the odds of ratings and job security. It is really up to the leaders in this room. It is up to you, the scions of this industry, to leave behind formulas and focus groups and your own fears of job security. Only with your courage and your vision can we begin to imagine a world of broadcasting where the general consensus of those with real power say, enough is enough. Now is the time to move away from our lesser selves. Now is the time to stop making money on the misfortunes of others and the prurient and salacious desires of the public. Now is the time to admit and recognize that we aren't just businessmen, but the guardians of the human spirit, with a responsibility to the health of this nation. That we can lift this country up with our programming. That instead of catering to the gossips and the scolds and the voyeurs, we can appeal to the better nature in our audience. The better nature of what this country is all about. This is a country filled with people of great compassion and tremendous generosity. This is a country that has survived dust bowls, depressions, that united to defeat Hitler and fascism and communism. We are a resilient people and a tenacious people, and we are ready for change. And we are ready to imagine a new broadcasting industry aesthetic that, respecting the better nature of the American people, produces shows that promote strength instead of fear, that does not divide but inspires, that does not promote hate but unity, that will not tear the weak down but build up their strength. Imagine a world of broadcasting where the American people are encouraged to reject despair and distrust. And when they turn their TVs and radios off at night and go to sleep, they possess strength and unity and compassion for those they disagree with. That's not out of the question. You can make that happen. It will be difficult and will fly in the face of conventional wisdom and standard operational procedure. But do we have any choice? The road we are on is leading us to a corruption of our former selves. We are better than that. You can help us reclaim our better nature, our perfect union. It isn't necessarily a matter of country before profit, or of patriotism and truth before personal comfort. There could be money to be made in appealing to our better selves. Wouldn't that be great? And if there isn't, and we came out of it a little less rich, but more unified and healthier as a nation, wouldn't that be something we could all be proud of? Thank you.
That was actor Tim Robbins delivering the keynote address at the National Association of Broadcasters annual convention, April 14th in Las Vegas. And to learn more about that, go to MediaGeek.net. On April 17th, the FCC took another shot at holding a public hearing on the issue of broadband network management, or really, network neutrality. This hearing happened in the heart of Silicon Valley at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. You'll recall that the first FCC hearing on this issue at Harvard University on February 25th was marred by the fact that Comcast, the nation's second-largest internet service provider, paid disinterested seat warmers to take up valuable space that otherwise would have gone to interested members of the public. No such tricks were pulled at the Stanford hearing, and Comcast decided not even to show up this time around. With more than 3 hours of expert testimony before the public testimony ever began, it's impossible to really summarize the meeting. Instead, I'm going to play for you excerpts from three panelists who each provide an interesting perspective. First, we'll hear from Rob Topolsky, a software quality engineer who was invited to speak because he is the person who first discovered Comcast blocking a BitTorrent traffic and determined how Comcast was doing it.
Thank you for inviting me to speak to this panel. For the past 25 years, I've been involved in networking protocols, and I owe some of my history to a partnership between the FCC and private citizens that created an amateur radio hobby, which led to my career in technology. I've worked on projects ranging from amateur radio packet bulletin board systems to one of the first commercial ports of the NCSA browser to scalable data center servers. And over the years, as a quality and testing engineer, I've been responsible for making sure that these products meet with certain technical standards. Another hobby of mine is barbershop harmony. In the Pacific Northwest, we like to stay dry, and 9 months out of the year it's raining, so I needed an indoor hobby. Peer-to-peer is a great medium for introducing new music to other people, and I was kind of trying to use it to introduce old music to other people and show some of the style and wonderful things available in barbershop harmony. Over the years, I've collected wonderful samples of wax cylinder recordings and printed music that are in that style, and I wanted to use the peer-to-peer networks to share them. And I found that I couldn't use the Nutella network, that no requests were coming through. And, of course, this was an interesting project for me because I was able to use my networking skills. Using packet tracing and end-to-end comparisons between Comcast and non-Comcast connections, I concluded that TCP reset flags were responsible for tearing down these established and working connections, and that this only occurred when the communication was happening on the Comcast network, and only, it occurred on the three top peer-to-peer protocols, and I've heard from others that it occurred on other peer-to-peer protocols as well. Investigating this further, I found that this was a technique that was nearly universally despised. As somebody mentioned earlier, it's the Great Firewall of China technique by tearing down established connections using these reset packets. In the IETF, has published a best current practices paper that talks about abusing the TCP reset for network management purposes. And that's BCP, or best current practice number 60, if you want to look that one up. As technologists do, I posted publicly about my findings, having been unable to find any information on Comcast about why their network behaves this way. Their support people didn't know. My findings were independently verified later, and it became an AP story and is probably the igniter of these hearings today. The impact of this behavior is striking, both at the ability for developers to develop for the internet and for consumers to buy with confidence. At the February hearing, David Reed told you, and I'm going to quote him, "Providing internet access implies adherence to a set of standard technical protocols and technical practices that are essential for the worldwide internet to work for all users." And I'm here to tell you from those perspectives that the entire internet community counts on that fact. I have to know as a developer that the web browser application that I'm working on in Santa Monica, California, is going to work on an ISP in Africa, without me having to travel to Africa to find out. I have to know that when I go to Best Buy and pick up a Sling box, that it's going to work on my ISP here in, or there in Hillsboro, Oregon, or on my wireless network, which has wireless internet offered. The word internet, therefore, means something very important, and it makes it easy for us to develop and easy for us to choose what products that we're going to use. Consumers in the internet community, therefore, were harmed when Comcast decided that it was going to do something secretive and non-standard and sell high-speed internet, but only to the people and the protocols that they preferred.
That was Rob Topolsky, the software quality engineer who first discovered Comcast blocking of BitTorrent file sharing traffic. And you're listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Bonnell. I am your host. Check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, home to the Media Geek blog, getting updated pretty frequently now that I'm getting settled. You'll find out more information about all the things that we're talking about on the show, as well as other stuff, at MediaGeek.net. Of course, you get the radio program at Radio.MediaGeek.net. Download, podcast, listen in the browser. It's all there, MediaGeek.net. And if you want to send any comments, please send them to me, Paul@MediaGeek.net. And now we'll listen to Barbara Van Shevik, assistant professor of law at the Stanford Law School, who provided an introduction to the second panel of the FCC hearing at Stanford, where the topic was consumer access to emerging internet technologies and applications.
Mr. Chairman, commissioners, thank you for giving me the opportunity to introduce this panel today. I'm an assistant professor at Stanford Law School, and I have a courtesy appointment at the Electrical Engineering Department. I'm also co-director of Stanford's Center for Internet and Society together with Larry Lessig. I have a PhD in computer science and a full legal education, and for the past 8 years, my research has been on the relationship between internet architecture, innovation, and the regulation of the internet. In my opening remarks, I would like to make 3 points. Allowing network providers to single out specific applications and block or degrade them in order to manage bandwidth on their networks would harm user choice and application-level innovation, the two things that the Internet Policy Statement is designed to protect. Second, even with disclosure, the market will not solve this problem. And third, to protect application-level innovation and user choice, the FCC needs to clarify that singling out specific applications and blocking or degrade them to manage bandwidth on a network is not reasonable network management and violates the Internet Policy Statement. Users choose the applications that best meet their needs and create the most value to them. If I'm working on an open source project that uses BitTorrent to create its source code, and the network provider chooses to single out BitTorrent to manage bandwidth on its network, I'm unable to use the applications that best the application that best meets my needs and use the internet in the way that is most valuable to me. This is pretty obvious. But what is the impact on application-level innovation? I recently met a Stanford graduate of the computer science program. Together with other graduates, he started a company that will develop a video application with peer-to-peer components. Because it's a great idea, he was able to present his concept to 6 private equity firms. He entered into formal discussions with 3. In these talks, all investors discussed the risk factors associated with his product. And in all talks, the fear that network providers would block or degrade his application was one of the top risk factors for all investors. If there was no market demand for his product, it would fail. And worse, if there was market demand, it would be blocked. The more likely it was to succeed, the more likely it was to be blocked. Each of the 3 firms passed on funding his innovation. This is a real problem. This story is not unique. And this story will become the norm unless the FCC adopts some baseline protections, ensuring that network providers cannot target and degrade particular applications in order to manage bandwidth on their networks.
That was Barbara Van Schevick, Assistant Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, speaking at the April 17th FCC hearing on broadband network management practices. And finally, we're going to hear from Ben Scott, Policy Director for Free Press. He was the last panelist to speak at the hearing, and he does a pretty good job of summing up the expert testimony.
I think this hearing is a pivotal moment in the short history of internet policymaking. And the arguments we've heard today fall roughly along 2 lines that represent 2 competing visions for the future of the internet, open versus closed. Will we embrace the openness that has shaped the internet to the present day, as Professor Lessig described it, or should we permit network owners to experiment and move to closed systems of content control that we've seen in cable television and broadcasting? Obviously, there are arguments on both sides, and I submit to you today that this is much bigger than Comcast and BitTorrent. I think that it's not hyperbole to say that few choices in the history of the FCC carry as much weight as this one does. So no pressure. So let me be clear about openness, because what I mean by openness doesn't mean an end to all network management. It doesn't mean that every bit should be treated exactly alike on the internet. It does not reject protecting children or copyright or security on the internet. Openness simply means that internet policy should promote free speech and commerce in the online marketplace as it always has. It means we should faithfully guard against interference from cable and telephone companies who have the power to become gatekeepers between consumers and producers of content on the internet. The Comcast case is just a bellwether. It is a test of the 2005 Internet Policy Statement. That is why it's been the focus of so much money, so much influence, so much attention. It is not ordinary in any way. The Commission adopted its policy statement to stand in the place of long-established and successful non-discrimination provisions in the Communications Act. Many of us feared then that handing over the legacy of an open communication system to such a weak guardian was a dangerous business. Well, today we sit here testing the mettle of that guardian. And let me be clear, the question before the Commission is not whether to regulate net neutrality or not. The question is not whether to establish a policy. You have established a policy in 2005. The question before the Commission is whether to apply that policy or not. And that's a very important distinction. The recent history of deregulation has led us to this bright red line of basic consumer protection. We should not stray beyond it. And we see the clash over this line all the time. We see it between open and closed, most famously in the congressional debate over net neutrality, but it's also in merger proceedings, it's in spectrum auctions, it's in wireless policy, it's in white spaces, it's in text messaging, and now it's in network management. And I'm pleased to say that several of the key decisions that you've made in the last year have leaned toward openness. I think that's a positive step. So, interestingly, what's the plot line that brought you to Stanford? Was it Silicon Valley finally living up to its billing and becoming the corporate titan to challenge AT&T and Comcast? Nope. It was a barbershop quartet. As you've heard from Rob Topolsky, He started all this because he couldn't share late 19th century barbershop quartet tunes with his buddies. Comcast first denied that they were blocking him from doing this, then they acknowledged it, then they directly challenged the legitimacy of the policy statement, and finally they reversed themselves and promised to work with everybody to stop this some point in the future. Honestly, I couldn't make this stuff up. But the important thing is that Rob has proven why this debate isn't about Google and isn't about AT&T and isn't about Comcast. It's about every consumer who wants to share or seek information on the internet. That's it. That's the bottom line. But few of us are capable of doing what Rob did. I don't have a packet sniffer on my computer. And fewer still will witness their personal conflicts with the cable company become first-tier business before a federal agency. And yet the pressure of public scrutiny and oversight has been highly effective, triggering some industry collaboration. But that doesn't mean the FCC can pack up and go home. You've still got to decide whether to apply the policy that you established in 2005 or not. The response to this case has been so extraordinary because it's a bellwether. And the side deals are not the magic of the market at work. They are the magic of regulatory threat at work. From my perspective, if the agency doesn't act decisively and apply the policies that's already made, the market signals that you're sending are let the dust settle and then do whatever the hell you want. From a consumer perspective, openness on the internet is a user experience. And that user experience is dependent on the seedbed of innovation that folks like Jason and Blake represent at the table today. And finally, I'd be remiss if I did not extend the olive branch to the cable industry. Because in my view, they do have a legitimate network congestion issue, in part because they have not yet upgraded their networks to deal with the broadband demand in the marketplace today. Now, the sooner we acknowledge and address that, the better, because there are many legitimate ways for network providers to handle capacity problems. Applications blocking just simply isn't one of them. And meanwhile, consumers are paying for all-you-can-eat broadband that happens to be too limited, and a fixed menu of cable TV that happens to be too broad. We just need to rebalance that equation a little bit. And I think the Commission should encourage that outcome. So at the end of the day, consumers are relying on the Commission to set a baseline standard to protect openness on the internet. A duopoly market of access providers is not going to discipline itself. Nor can we expect that every time there's a violation, we'll have fans of barbershop quartets riding in like white knights to save the day. This is a clear moment for the agency to act. The future of the internet for everyone depends on it. I thank you for your time, and I look forward to your questions.
And that was Ben Scott, Policy Director for the Media Reform Group Free Press, speaking at the April 17th public FCC hearing on broadband network management practices. And I'll have links to more coverage of this hearing at the Media Geek website. That's MediaGeek.net. This brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with more news and views in our media environment. In the meantime, check out the Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. You can listen to and download the program at radio.mediageek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. If you have any comments about the program, I'd love to read them. Send them to paul@mediageek.net. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and also is heard on 12 other community stations across North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, KWMD in Kosilov in Anchorage, Alaska, Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington, WVEW in Brattleboro, Vermont, CHMA in Sackville, New Brunswick, WBCR in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. The Media Geek Radio Show is available for free to any non-commercial community station. Just send email to paul@mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.